How do you talk about race? Do you talk about race? It's a topic many of us would just as soon avoid, but it's an important part of the American conversation and increasingly a vital issue in the world of business. But talking about race and racism is rarely easy, which is why Kwame Christian has written the book, How to Have Difficult Conversations About Race, Practical Tools for Necessary Change in the Workplace and Beyond. Kwame is the founder and CEO of the American Negotiation Institute, the host of the podcast Negotiate Anything, and author of the best-selling book, Finding Confidence in Conflict. Here he is to share five big ideas from his latest.
Hello, my friends, and welcome to my book, Bite. And this is Kwame Christian, the founder and CEO of the American Negotiation Institute and the host of the number one negotiation podcast in the world, Negotiate Anything, and the author of the new book, How to Have Difficult Conversations About Race, Practical Tools for Necessary Change in the Workplace and Beyond. And so I'm going to give you a quick summary of the five key points from my book. So first, I'm going to start off by talking about why we should have these conversations. We have these difficult conversations about race because we care. So what is it that we care about? We care about our colleagues and we care about our relationships with them. We care about fairness. We care about progress. And when you care about something, you talk about that thing. Right? Think about it. There's nothing in the world that people care about so much that they just don't talk about. And so one of the easiest ways to show your colleagues that you care is by talking about things that matter. Point number two, we need to understand the psychology of these difficult conversations. Difficult conversations about race are especially challenging for two main reasons. Reason number one, emotions. Reason number two, psychological considerations like bias, right? So what are the things that make these difficult conversations about race particularly emotionally challenging? Conversations about race trigger heightened levels of emotionality for two main reasons. It comes down to identity and morality. So identity, that answers the question, who am I? What does a person like me do in these types of situations? What does a person like me say? What does a person like me believe? And then when it comes to morality, that answers the question, what does it mean to be a good or bad person? And when those two things seem to be challenged or threatened in any kind of interaction, it is going to heighten the level of emotionality that you face. And so understanding that will help us to create strategies to circumvent that, and we'll get into that a little bit later. And now when we're talking about the psychology side, I'm going to focus in on bias, but I'm going to take a different approach to bias. Bias is a subconscious preference towards something or a subconscious prejudice against something. It's usually either reflexively good or reflexively bad. I'm introducing bias to this book. I'm not only identifying the different biases that could be at play in these interactions, I'm also helping people to feel more empowered about the reality of biases. Because one of my biggest frustrations is that a lot of times when we talk about bias in the workplace, we only look at it from a negative perspective and from a very disempowering perspective too, because we say there's bias here and it makes things bad. But for me, in this book, I want people to look at bias as a strategic consideration. What biases could be working against me? And now strategically, how can I work against those types of things? What are some of those positive biases that I can mobilize in order to overcome some of those negative biases? So here's an example. There's a bias called the affinity bias. Just to keep it really simple, because you are like me, I like you. So if we look at somebody else and we see a bit of ourselves in them, we will like them more. That is a positive bias that we could have toward somebody. So in my book, I tell the story about how I strategically used affinity bias in one interaction in order to overcome some potential biases that may have existed. There are several studies that have shown consistent bias in healthcare against Black, Latinx, and other dark-skinned patients. Knowing this, back when Whitney was pregnant and I would accompany her to her maternity wellness checks, I would always find a way to casually mention that Whitney was a doctor. And the doctors and nurses' eyes would always light up and they would ask questions like, oh, where do you practice? Do you know so-and-so? As soon as they knew that they were talking to a fellow medical professional, their whole demeanor changed and they treated Whitney a lot better. We didn't know whether or not she was going to be treated unfairly, but we minimized the likelihood that she would be by clearly demonstrating a similarity. And I don't think people really fully appreciate just how powerful biases can be, because bias doesn't only affect our decision-making and how we treat other people, it also impacts how we perceive objective reality. In one study, researchers performed an experiment where they had participants taste wine while in an MRI scanner to record their brain activity. So here's where it gets really interesting, because the researchers in the study showed the participants the price of a wine and then allowed them to sample that wine and then asked them to rate it based on how much they enjoyed it, all while monitoring their brain activity. The researchers then repeated the steps with a differently priced wine. Now, this is where it gets really fun, because what the participants didn't know was that they were given the same wine both times. The only difference between the wines was how much the participants were told that they cost. But despite this fact, the subjects reported that the more expensive wine tasted better than the cheaper one. And what's even more fascinating is the fact that the participants' brain activity was greater when they tasted the wine with the higher price point. This shows that they genuinely perceived a difference in taste because of their beliefs about the wine. And then when you take that study and then you replace wine with people, it becomes really dark. This becomes really troubling because we're realizing that we might be walking together, talking together, while living in very different realities. And so we have to recognize that the biases that people are going to have, it's going to completely color their experiences and how they perceive the world. And so as much as we would love to just resolve these conflicts using facts and data and things like that, we have to recognize that bias is going to contort reality in a way that could potentially be problematic. So this begs the question, what do we actually do? How do we overcome biases? Well, first, check out my book. But second is strategy. And again, that almost seems too simplistic, right? But think about it. How many times do we actually go into these impactful conversations with a strategy? Strategy, if we're just looking at a simple definition, strategy, most simply, is a plan that helps you win. When I'm talking about winning in the context of these difficult conversations, it's about your goals for the conversation. So for me, I'm winning if I'm moving toward my ultimate goal and if we're able to deepen our mutual understanding through the process. And if the conversation ends with me and my conversation partner knowing more than when we began. If I'm able to accomplish those things, then I am winning. And the only way we can do this is by being goal-oriented. We need to make sure that the strategies that we put together are taking us closer to our goals. Because again, like I mentioned, these conversations are very emotional. And if you're very emotional, a lot of times what you will be tempted to do is called cathartic communication. And cathartic communication occurs when you are venting at your opponent. This is not persuasive. This does not take you closer to your goal unless your goal is simply to hurt people. But again, remember, this is the context of the employment setting. That's what this book is focused on. And so here's one of the strategies that I talk about, and I call it perspective expansion. So there's a folktale called The Blind Men and the Elephant. Six blind men are asked to describe an elephant based only on touch. Each gives a completely different description. But not surprisingly, based on where on the elephant they go, they give very different descriptions. One man feels the tusk and says that an elephant is like a spear. One man feels the leg and says an elephant is like a big, strong column. Another man touches the tail and says that an elephant is like a rope. So then the men began arguing, and it begs the question, who's right and who's wrong? Well, they are all right, and at the same time, they're all wrong, based on which part of the elephant they're experiencing. And a lot of times when it comes down to biases, these biases that we have come about as the result of our lived experiences. What did we do growing up? Who taught us growing up? What type of media do we consume? We're all experiencing different parts of the elephant. And so the question I want you to start asking yourself is, which part of the elephant are they seeing? And then because biases create blind spots, which part of the elephant aren't they seeing? So instead of attacking the person directly saying, you're wrong because of this reason, you want to take the time and empathize and listen and understand and say, okay, what is it that you're seeing? And then once I have led the conversation by showing you how to listen, it makes it more likely for you to listen to me, because listening, vulnerability, those things are reciprocal in nature. You have to give it first in order to receive it. And so I have a concept called conversational leadership, where I'm not just thinking of myself as trying to have an effective conversation. Through the conversation, I am coaching you as to how to effectively have a conversation. And then I get to share my side of the elephant. And so it is an approach that doesn't directly attack what people are believing, what they're feeling. Because remember, just like the wine, it's not just that they have been deceived. It is that based on their perceptions, based on their biases, they genuinely believe what they're saying to be true. It's not an issue of right or wrong in this case. And this patient, respectful, humble approach of expansion helps us to overcome some of the biases that we're going to run into. The fourth point that I want to share with you is the compassionate curiosity framework. Now, this is my unique approach to handling difficult conversations, and the goal is to help you to understand what to say and when to say it with maximum impact. And so it's a three-step framework that can be used not only in the external conversation with your conversation partner, but also internally as a tool of introspection, emotion management, and bias reduction. Number one, acknowledge and validate emotions. Number two, get curious with compassion. And number three, joint problem solving. And so it'll help you to know what to say and when to say it with maximum impact. So let's say there is a situation where there is a difficult conversation and the other person becomes emotional. Step one, acknowledge and validate the emotions. We're going to say, it sounds like, it seems like, or I can tell that. That is going to allow you to place an emotional label on the person, give them the opportunity to decompress and vent, and then calm down through the process. The next step is getting curious with compassion. Here, we're asking open-ended questions with a compassionate tone to gather information and empathize with the other side. And then thirdly, what we're doing is we're working with them to solve the problem. We're answering the question, what does our relationship look like going forward? How do we work together collaboratively to solve the problem at hand? And so this is a situation where it should feel like a brainstorming type of session where you're working through the challenges together. Now, internally, let's talk about how this works internally. So first, acknowledge and validate your own emotions. You're going to label those emotions to yourself. And then you're going to get curious with self-directed compassion. Let's say you might hypothesize that you have a bias. If you are confronted with that reality in your introspective process, you might be too hard on yourself. So we have to approach these conversations with self-directed compassion so we don't stop the process too short because we're too critical and we say, oh, this doesn't feel good. I'm not going to go through this introspective process. So self-directed compassion is important. Then lastly, joint problem solving directed internally is reconciling the differences between your heart and your mind. What will satisfy you emotionally? What is the emotional challenge you're trying to overcome? But at the same time, considering what is it that you need to do? What is the decision that you need to make? What do you need to say in this difficult conversation to solve the problem? And so the compassionate curiosity framework is designed to help you navigate these challenging conversations, and it's flexible as well. And in the book, we walk through several examples of how this can be used internally and externally so people understand what they can do in a practical sense to address these difficult conversations. And then lastly, allyship and advocacy. If a tree falls in the woods and nobody hears it, did it really make a sound? And I always thought this was a really silly question because my response was always, who cares? But if we replace a few words, we get a very different question. If an advocate isn't able to create positive change, are they really an advocate? If you call yourself an advocate, but your words and actions don't lead to meaningful change, then are you really an advocate? And so when we think about the difference between an advocate and an ally, it can be confusing. To advocate is to speak on behalf of or support. So for me, the term advocate is more appropriate for the purposes of this book because it focuses on taking action, using persuasion and influences regardless of your racial identity. Whether or not you deserve the moniker depends on whether or not you're actually able to create positive change. And a crucial part of being able to create change is how active of a role you're taking in persuading the people around you. So if you want to maximize your impact, start with this simple truth. Racial inequity is a problem of bad policy, not bad people. You'll get a greater return on investment if you focus on the policies that shape an organization rather than the personal beliefs of the individuals within it. And that, my friend, is my quick summary of the book. I hope you enjoyed it. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Kwame. That was Kwame Christian with 5 big ideas from How to Have Difficult Conversations About Race, Practical Tools for Necessary Change in the Workplace and Beyond. For more help with these tough conversations, listen to our book bite for How to Talk to Your Boss About Race, Speaking Up Without Getting Shut Down by Yvonne Hutchinson. I'm Rufus Griscom. Thanks for listening.